Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience, also faculty associate in law and public affairs at Great Princeton University.
So we just lived through and watched a pretty remarkable and troubling set of days here in the United States. Over the weekend, there was a rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, the home of the University of Virginia, where white nationalist groups came to defend white power and to defend kind of the threats that they feel they face. The specific issue that the rally took place around was the removal of a monument to Robert E. Lee, but it was clear if you watch any video of what was going on the night before the rally, and the rally itself involved something much bigger than a debate about monuments. The president then really managed to shock and stun many people, which is difficult to do. First, by saying after the events unfolded and one of the counter protesters was killed when one of the people there rammed a car into the crowd, that both sides, were to blame.
Oh, there's enough blame for all sides.
All sides. He followed up the next day.
Both the car and the
2 days
paralegal
later.
Who got run over. Both
right.
sides.
And he followed. Was it 2 days later? He had a kind of scripted denouncement of white nationalism and extremism. But then he had a press conference the following day where everything seemed to come undone. And he expressed a lot of sympathy for some of the arguments that these organizations were making. And he went back to the all sides, both sides were implicated. So it was really dramatic. It brought the issue of race in the United States back to the forefront. It brought his connection, President Trump, to extremist groups on the right into the limelight. There's been a debate. Should we be shocked, or is this just a continuum of what's been going on since the campaign? But here we are talking about it. What do you think?
I think my president, and he is still my president since I'm an American, I think my president is a racist Nazi sympathizer. That's what I think. Now, as we've disclaimed in the past on this program, it's Wednesday right now. We're recording in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And there may be more features that are not fully recognized.
Yeah.
But as of Wednesday, that's what he looks like.
Yeah.
Now, that's a little – some might say that there's another side to this.
Right. Right.
Some might. Which is, you know, maybe – I don't know. Like if he – if this – if these protesters are against – let's see. I guess they are against Jews and the end of slavery. I think those are the things they were against. And so, you know, there is another side to that. And it's a side that hasn't gotten a fair hearing since the age of Jim Crow. Yeah. And so maybe that's what Making America Great Again is.
Right. Well, you know, this has been an issue that even though some people are surprised or some people want to argue this is some revealing moment, it's been an issue since the campaign. And his campaign in the fall – and in the primaries, we saw these organizations which fall under the alt-right label, which I'm not really sure is the most useful label.
I think white nationalist, is adequate as a label at this
point. Right. They've been circulating in the orbit. He has retweeted statements. And just as important, he's played into some of the racial arguments that even people outside of those groups, but who have a pretty hard line on issues of race, of culture, of sexuality, subscribe to. And this is nothing new. You can look at immigration. You could look at gender. So the question always was, what do we make of this? Is this the totality of what this politician is about? How much does it play into what his supporters see and are looking at? But this weekend, I don't know, after that press conference, he did not disassociate himself. No. It was more than just both sides. He was actually echoing arguments that they were making through the monuments, which, again, I just think is a kind of proxy issue for what this rally was about. It was it's pretty hard to say he doesn't have some sympathy for what we heard on the ground.
Yeah, I guess there's two ways of interpreting, you know, one – I think there's a danger of getting a little bit too three-dimensional here, right? Because it's as people who comment on a talk program, we can get fancy and talk about it. I guess the fancy explanation is these are his supporters and he doesn't want to walk away from a key constituency. And with his approval down in the 30 to 40% range, median around 35 or 36%, he's down to hardcore people who are not just people who voted for him, but a more restricted subset of people who really get him and he really gets them. And so maybe one simple calculation is just these are his people. Mm-hmm. And as far as these sentiments go, well, you know, this has been known for some time. He, if I remember correctly, his first wife, I believe, pointed out that he was said to keep a book of Hitler's speeches by his bedside, which seemed kind of extravagant. It seemed kind of like a cheap hit job to say that anybody would do that. Back when he was a landlord in the 1980s, he would have covenants and restrictions that would keep out African Americans. And there was, I guess, some sense in which this was dirty pool or it was considered too secondhand or there was something about it that was just so far outside the range of acceptable conversation that it would be unbelievable.
Yeah.
But the reality of having the president of the United States on television, I'm not a TV viewer, but apparently on television with members of his cabinet in front of him being witness to this is obviously pretty arresting. And there's really no avoiding the thing I said before. And I realized that it sounded perhaps inflammatory for me to say he's a racist Nazi sympathizer, but what else would one call that?
Right.
And in fact, I would say that if you look at what people like Richard Spencer or what have you, or David Duke say, I think that at some level they'd say, well, you know, racist is kind of a charged word, but you're right. He's with us. And so they would agree, you're right. He's one of us. So I guess one thing I'm curious about is there a counter argument to this label?
Well, I think there's no counter argument to the fact that, he took a stand that was sympathetic. And
he took a side.
You can't undo what he did.
No.
I really don't believe you can undo that more than almost anything else. He can undo being hawkish or being against international alliances and then saying—
Evidently, you can walk back the threat of nuclear war.
Right.
So
no.
There's all kinds of things one can walk back.
But this, I don't think this will work. I mean, I think especially after the final press conference where it was him. That was him. And you didn't get the sense it was politically calculated. You actually got the sense this is what he thinks. I don't know. I did watch it, and that was the feeling at least I had. And so this will now be part of his presidency. Is there a counter-argument? I mean, the best political counter-argument is what you said, that this is a totally strategic choice, that you don't want to alienate not the groups there, that's not who he's sympathetic for, and he meant it when he said, I denounce that, but some of the broader arguments they make about what he would call political correctness or about the identity of the South, that he is sympathetic to arguments that many of his supporters face, or he's politically calculating, I can't do anything. That's the best case, but even that sounds like George Wallace. That sounds like I'm going to, go for the worst elements of my constituency and play to them. And so I don't think there's a good way to look at any of this unless you are sympathetic to those arguments.
Well, let's see. So I guess the news clips that have been going around are clips of what segregationist governors said in the 1950s and early 1960s. Or perhaps not to poke at our own history a little bit, but if we look back at things that Woodrow Wilson said when he was president of the United States, he was very much sympathetic to Jim Crow and those issues. And so there are times in American history when these opinions were commonplace and acceptable at the highest levels of government, but those times were 60 to 100 years ago. And 100 years ago is when these monuments were put up, right? Like around the time of the turn of the 19th century, or the early 20th century, is when these monuments were put up in the first place. And so in some respect, the whole thing is authentic and real and a look back at American history from 100 years ago, at who we were as a nation back at a time when people were suppressed based on the color of their skin.
Well, the question it raised, look, yes. And so, and the monument, what you're referring to, if people out there haven't heard, is the argument over the monument, why take down Confederate flags?
Right. So the ostensible trigger of the whole thing
is
the taking down of a monument to General Robert E. Lee.
Right. And so, one argument is that has been is that a lot of these monuments were put into place in the 1920s to 40s period, and then in the 1910s to 30s, and then the 1950s and 60s, and that the monuments were not really meant to commemorate the people in the monument or to commemorate the region, that the monuments themselves were part of a white backlash to progress on race relations. So the argument there is that it's perfectly justified to say maybe we shouldn't have those. Maybe we should take them down. But the bigger argument is something that is at the heart of the Trump presidency for me. And I've wrote about this during the campaign. This is part of his campaign is not about economic populism, and it's not about just addressing the concerns of people who are left out of the economy. It was a conservative populist campaign that played on issues like nativism and race and even anti-Semitism as a way to stir up anger and resentment that is out there, and it has a very long trajectory. What happened this weekend is, I think for more people, it became defining in terms of what he's about. But for me, the question is, what does that say not just about him, but about the country? What does it say about the Republican Party? Kind of what happens after you see that extracted from President Trump, which is a different question.
Yeah, well, let's go over this a little bit. So let's see. So about 46% of people voted for Trump, but that does not make that 46% of people white nationalists.
Right.
It makes them 46% of people who are pretty strong loyalist Republicans and will vote that way no matter what. Just the same way that there are, to take one of the bigger defeats of the last 30 years for Democrats, Dukakis. So there's a certain minimal number of people who will vote Democratic because that's just the way they vote. So we're talking about this fraction of people who really like who he is in a really authentic sort of way, the 40% of Republican primary voters who were with him from the beginning. And just to go over some arithmetic, that's just it's funny how, a lot of like math punditry is just doing multiplication of fractions. Okay, so let's see. So about 30% of people are loyalist partisan Democrats or Republicans. Uh-huh. And then the Republican primaries, about 40% of those were with Donald Trump from the beginning. So that works out to 12%. So that's about 1 in 8 Americans who are reached by surveys liked Trump better than anything else out there. Like, it's not that they liked him versus Hillary Clinton or John Kasich or what have you. They liked him first and foremost. And so 1 out of 8 Americans feel that way. Well, 1 out of 8 Americans were pretty interested in Father Coughlin in the 1930s. And I imagine that in the 1980s, or in the 1970s, at least 1 in 8 Americans, obviously mostly white, almost entirely white, were interested in things like segregation and racially restrictive covenants and the like. And so the way we got here is that 1 in 8 has their guy in the White House. And guess what? The other, 2 or 3 out of 8, let's call them regular Republicans, although, there are not quite so many of them.
Yeah.
That other wing of the Republican Party is presumably horrified and also a little scared because these are their own voters. And if you're a Republican official, you can't abandon 1/3 of your own voters or whatever fraction it might be. You see what I'm getting at? And so I think what it says about us is that if you take 1 out of 8 people in a system where that is a large enough fraction to make headway in the political system, then you can get some pretty unusual results. One way to look at the Republican primaries in 2016 is that party loyalty is down, fewer people vote in primaries, and white nationalists saw a way in. This is, and they got their way in. And so the Richard Spencer / David Duke types saw that here is their guy. Yeah. And he's a guy who's 71 years old. As we've talked about before, he's he mental decline happens once you hit your 70s. Not that he's got mental problems per se, but things like self-restraint and hiding what you think. Think about all the things that we hide in everyday life. Not horrible things, not things that make us monsters, but just things that, I don't know, all kinds of rando things that pop into your head. And he's just letting it all out. And all that stuff that's been in his head for decades just came out in that press conference. And it just came out of our televisions and our radios and our news feeds.
Yeah.
And just is now coding us all.
The hard part is, based on that, and I had a whole debate with someone the other day, private debate, where, you know, I was saying, look, you can make these arguments about partisanship and partisan loyalty on any ticket, which we've both made. It helps explain why he won. But the party now owns him. It's too the party can't simply disassociate themselves from this.
Oh, yeah. Now he's the leader. And so the thing is, leaders pull parties towards them.
Right.
And now there's a whole party that, like it or not, they are drawn towards who he is.
Yeah. And I can't look. And this person was saying, well, I imagine that this will blow over and the Republicans won't be tarnished with this. And most Republicans are not in this camp and they're not racists. And I agree with that. But that said, this party nominated him. Yeah,
most Republicans are not white nationalists. Okay.
Not a big
think that'll survive editing.
But my point, right. But my point is, look, the Republicans nominate him. The Republicans are key to his victory. It's not the white nationalists. It's partisan politics.
It's part of
party loyalty.
It is a major wing of their party.
And they've stood by him generally when this press conference was simply the kind of a worst example of things we've heard repeatedly from him and problems that have been there. You know, a week ago he was joking about police brutality. So this is not new. And so at some level, I imagine this can hurt the Republican kind of reputation or image. Democrats suffered from being the party of segregation and really had to work to get around – to get over that for decades. And I wonder – what this will do, but I don't think Republicans can simply make statements and distance themselves from a president who ran as a Republican, won as a Republican, and has survived with a Republican Congress pretty well.
So at what point does a party, any political party in American life, have a rift so deep that it has to split, that it has to either change or split? So if we think about the Democratic Republicans back in the 18th and early 19th centuries, if we think about ways that Democrats and Republicans have shifted over the last 200 years, there are these times when a party changes its identity. And by my reckoning, we've had about, about 20 years during which there's been this rumbling on the Republican side of this wing that is explicitly in some ways racial and nativist. And there's this other wing that say, I don't know, interested in business and lower taxes and shrinking government and shrinking benefits. And so there's a certain common cause there. But I wonder whether there's a rift here that is starting to become apparent. And just to complete the thought, if I'm in any part of that coalition and if I'm trying to get stuff passed like the repeal of the Affordable Care Act or the scaling back of Medicaid or tax reform, so rearranging taxes to give a further tax cut to the top 1% of income earners, to income levels. At what point does that rift become apparent? Now, just to put it purely in terms of political calculus, I find it hard to believe that they're going to get that much of their agenda at this point. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe they will. I heard that President Trump is once again calling upon the Senate to take up health care repeal. I'm having a hard time imagining him making much headway since he's shown himself to be a policy lightweight and he's got some other stuff going on right now. But maybe the answer is his party's not going to get what it wants with him as president. So maybe that'll be the trigger. Because what you see what I'm saying? Like, they stuck with him this long.
Right.
I don't know. These things were here's the counterargument. It's old news. We already heard about this during the campaign.
Right.
So what's new now? So that would be the counterargument.
Right. No, that is the counterargument. And it's also the counterargument. It's like, what is going – he's only in his first half year.
Yeah, let's give him a chance.
Well, no, not give him a chance, but what is actually going to happen? So either the Republicans lose control of Congress, which is not clearly going to happen in 2018, or in 2020, a Democrat wins or a Republican wins. But nothing in the short term is going to happen, and this is old news, as you're saying. And so would the party split? The split that always comes to mind is the Democratic split. And it was important. One of the key moments.
Which split? You mean like in the 60s?
Yeah, in the 50s.
The civil rights split.
Civil rights split. And it's more than civil rights. It's urban policy. Yeah. It's economic policy. And you had the Southerners were in control of the party back then, and they had been in control since at least 1930s. They controlled the committees. They controlled the conventions. And, they made sure certain issues were protected, like civil rights. But the party starts to split in the 1940s. The key moment comes, and I can't imagine what that moment might be today, where Hubert Humphrey, who is running for the Senate, he gives a speech in 1948 at the Philadelphia Convention. And he's this young kind of maverick, and he's insisting civil rights. And he says,
Northern Democrats. So the Northern.
He represents the Northern Democrats, and he sits at the convention where all these Southern Democrats are sitting. And he says, "My friends, to those who say we are rushing this issue of civil rights, I say to them, we are 172 years late. To those who say that this civil rights program is an infringement on states' rights, I say this. The time has arrived in America for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadow of states' rights and to walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights." And that's a key moment, and it will take many years for that to happen. But that party will shift by the 1964-65 period. But I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't know if this inter-party tension that's been playing out for a long time now, at least since Bush was president, he was facing the same issues, whether some of these hardline positions will finally kind of disappear from the party.
Well, as I learned in one of our early episodes of this program, that shift was reflected by Hubert Humphrey in 1948, as you just said, but it was rumbling for a while. It was such a revelation to me to learn that the American Federation of Labor and the CIO, the Congress of International Organizations.
This is our episode with Eric Schickler.
That was such a good episode. Yeah. I learned so much. I really recommend that book. But I just remember understanding that unions began the drive towards civil rights. Mm-hmm. And unions came together, and it was at that time that the New Deal and civil rights, which were not the same thing at all, came together and became something unified, where today we think of those things as being part of the same worldview of how people ought to be treated in American society, where you can imagine, social safety net and treating people equally seem like they're part of the same idea. But you're talking about a time when that was not yet the Democratic Party's position. It became that position starting in the 1960s, but it wasn't that in the 1940s. And so that was a case where the change rumbled up from the grassroots and from organizers who were rank and file. So if we were to ask the question, and I know we were talking about the Republican Party, but we could just as well ask it about the Democratic Party. Are there rumblings coming up from the grassroots that are changing who they are? Now, one argument I would say is that based on what we've been seeing and based on the 40% of Republican voters that Trump commanded during the primaries, we are seeing it. And what we're seeing is that 40% is a 40% of Republicans who are interested in nativism.
You mean what, moving in the wrong direction?
Well, what I'm saying is that actually what we're seeing is the birth cries of a movement that is finally saying exactly what it thinks on the national stage in the form of a somewhat disinhibited press conference where we got to look all the way into what Trump thinks.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's – now, is that going to – will the whole party go with it or will it divide them?
Yeah.
It seems kind of like if, you know, people who are principled conservatives, interested in equal opportunity or economic liberty, it seems hard to imagine that they're going to go along with that. But it's out there, it's up front, and it's apparently it'll not go away for as long as Trump is president.
Yeah, and it's hard. I don't know from you who looks at polls and looks at numbers, can a Republican Party keep winning after this, presidential tickets? So I see how the party is changing or parts of the party are changing. But is this viable to have a Republican president do this weekend and do it repeatedly before this weekend, versions of it, and in 2020 go to a country that's more pluralistic, more integrated, more diverse, and not either – look, if he's running or another Republican wins and he doesn't want to run or beats him in a primary challenge, is it possible to do this and not shake up the electorate? Is it so ingrained, the polarization?
Well, the way to do it is something like what happened last November, which is if it's about messages of white nationalism, then that's not necessarily a winning message. But if it's about hating the other side,
right,
then that could work, right? So if we think about Hillary Clinton, as Donald Trump seems to spend an awful lot of time doing, and Fox News seems to spend a lot of time doing, you know, the talk is not about her competence as president,
yep,
as a politician, her detailed plans for what she would like to see, her ideas about children's health or families. None of those came up. It got turned into, I don't know, stuff about her email server habits.
Yeah.
And so that kind of descent into minutiae works pretty well on the national stage. Because, look, people have short attention spans. Like here we are all wrapped up in this the disbanding of the jobs panels or about a Civil War monument in Charlottesville. But I don't know, a few days ago, I thought we were on the brink of dropping a nuke on North Korea. Wasn't that what was happening a few days ago?
Yes, no, absolutely. And
Trump seems to have forgotten.
Right.
And I can't shake the feeling that people have a short attention span. And at some point it's going to be, I don't know, let's just fast forward to some future when it's Kamala Harris and Jason Kander running for president in 2020. And it turns into the fact that Jason Kander can't really shoot a gun and Kamala Harris has some minor financial impropriety someplace. And then suddenly voters and members of the media will be running off after these shiny objects. We should record this. We are recording it.
We are recording it. That's the whole point of this.
Because if it turns out to be Kamala Harris and Jason Kander and it's that, this is going to look pretty good.
Then you won't have to eat a bug.
Yeah, thanks.
No, it's true. I mean, that is in the heat of the moment. It's not that you are focused on it, but you think this will be lasting. And the question is maybe that's just not how it works anymore. Maybe it's not even in 2020. It's like by next week. We won't even be on this issue, although it has been a defining debate for him. It's not like it goes away.
He'll
bring it back.
Yeah.
Chief of Staff Kelly is not going to control him despite all the predictions.
No. Like I did see a video clip of just a close-up of Kelly's face during that press conference, and that was kind of fascinating to watch.
It looked like, why did I take this job?
Yeah, just wincing. And, yeah. So one thing I'm wondering about is it hasn't really – I don't know. Has it gotten around that maybe there's a 25th Amendment remedy to this? How much does that get talked
about? I've seen little snippets of
it. So just to remind everybody, the 25th Amendment of the Constitution has a provision for removing the president on account of disability. And the vice president and half the cabinet can vote and do this. Now, you're smiling.
It's not going to happen. No.
Okay. A lot of things are not going to happen. So let's see. So, okay.
I can hear the list.
The blue wall.
Right.
No way is Trump going to win Michigan or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, or maybe no way would a Nazi sympathizer hold a press conference as president of the United States. So sure. Okay, you know what? I would say that in this weird alternate reality that we've all entered, I agree that it is also unthinkable that the vice president and the cabinet would remove a sitting president on account of disability slash inability. I agree about that. I'm just asking. Glenn Beck used to say, I'm just asking questions.
Right. Look, the two issues are beyond that, but it is connected in terms of the calculations and feelings of the Republicans. As a party on principle, there is a debate now, it seems, that what do we stand for and how do we respond to what just happened? And I think there are Republicans. I'm not so cynical to think that some are not legitimately questioning, what do we do? We can't do this. And the second is pure, which gets back to my question, electoral calculations. Yeah. And what is this going to do?
Okay, so if we took high-level officials of the Republican Party nationwide and like found a way to find out what they really thought and what their real social attitudes were, yeah, I'd say ballpark about half of them are pretty horrified about what's happening right now.
And the other half?
I don't know. The other half might be okay with it. I mean, they'd say that it's a little impolite the way he said it, but
– or they both sides do stuff like this. I'd say that's another way to think about it.
Like, don't
it's a justification.
Right. Don't you think the Blue Lives Matter? And so one can imagine that about – you know, at the very highest level, one can imagine that about half of elected officials think that this is an affront to decent society, and half of them think, yeah, he's a little crude, but he's saying – what a lot of us think.
Do you think moving it back, so 2020 or amendments to remove presidents, let's put that aside, but very real is 2018. We're now in August of 2017. In November, we have midterm elections.
Yeah.
Historically, they're not great for the president's party. Certain times, they're really bad for the president's party. There's this argument out there that I've seen, and I can't remember who's been writing it, maybe Nate Cohen, that it's not going to be so great for Democrats. And I can't remember who wrote the article because of gerrymandering and because of built-in
advantages. Okay. So let's see.
What do you think?
Yeah, let's go there. All right. Yeah. So, okay. So first, there's like a lot of substantive
stuff. It doesn't get better for President Trump. This is basically what we have until then.
Okay.
So how does it affect it?
There's been a tabulation over at Daily Kos Elections of about 30 special elections that have occurred since November.
Yeah.
And in those 30 elections, state legislative elections, special congressional elections, the median result has been 13 points of swing towards Democrats from Republicans. So, for instance, that would mean that if that held nationwide, Republicans won the national popular vote for Congress by one percentage point back then in November, that would be Democrats winning it by 12 points. A 13-point swing goes from minus 1 to plus 12. Okay. So that means that if this held, if the current national mood held, then that would be Democrats winning by 12 points nationwide next November. That is enough to win the House of Representatives next November. The amount now there's gerrymandering, a topic that I am well acquainted with. There is population clustering, and those two factors together create an uphill battle for Democrats, where Democrats would need to win the national popular vote by ballpark 7 to 9%. And so, if there were an election now, 12% is greater than 7 to 9%, and so that would be enough. Now, there are many imponderables here. Will Democrats get their act together and have a message other than we're not the other guy? Do they need such a message? Will sentiments now hold up next November? Will they get worse? It is sometimes the case that at midterm elections, trends do not become apparent until the election is nigh. And then there's this runaway effect where in the last couple of months, opinion starts running off against the incumbents. That's happened in several wave elections. So where are we going to be? Maybe things will regress back to the mean and maybe things won't be so bad for Republicans. But I think that at a minimum, it is clear that the House of Representatives is in play next November. Whether it'll change control, hard to say.
Not the Senate?
Senate is tough because it requires, in order for the Senate to flip control, it requires something like Jeff Flake in Arizona to lose his race, or it requires Ted Cruz in Texas to lose his race. That's a pretty hard lift for Democrats. But then, you know, if public opinion goes sufficiently against Republicans, one can imagine it. I think it's tough, but one could imagine it.
And if you're talking about, so to connect the story, so we're talking about this weekend's fallout. And say it does last, and say there's more of it. How does that affect House races? The House races, that it can affect most likely or what everyone calls purple districts.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah.
There's a mix.
Right. So like locally, for instance, like let's look at some local races. Here in New Jersey, there's Leonard Lance. There's Rodney Frelinghuysen. You know, Lance is a personally decent guy. We've had him here on the program. He's genteel in many ways. He's been sucked into the Washington vortex. And so does he get by in his personal decency, or does he get sucked into this undertow of national sentiment? Frelinghuysen has a reputation of being from a moderate, long-lasting Republican family, but he is stuck tight with Republican leadership on things like healthcare repeal. And so what's going to happen to these people? What's the temperature going to be like in their districts next November? And so... As you point out, it is typical for the party that holds the presidency to lose seats at midterm elections. Those losses can be up to 50 to 70 seats, 80 seats, if I remember correctly. And it only requires loss of a few dozen seats for control to switch. We're in a period for the last 10, 15 years, we've been in a period of very closely fought control over the House of Representatives. The closest, the last period like this was during the Gilded Age, like during, you know, right at the dawn of Jim Crow in the 1880s, 1890s, Congress was very closely divided. And so we are in a period of closely fought elections where these waves can pull Congress one direction or the other. So I think, ballpark, I would say if I had to place money on an even money bet, no insects.
Yeah.
Right. Like no eating insects, just an even money bet. The even money bet would be on Democrats.
Yeah.
You know, whether it'll really happen, you know, we'll find out again. Senate, yeah, I mean, basically senators this year are in 2018 were elected in 2012 when Barack Obama was reelected. And so what that means is that it was a reasonably good year for Democrats in 2012. And what that means is that for Democrats to do better, they have to do better than Obama did against Romney in 2012. And so that's the bar that needs to be cleared.
But in the Senate, you have now more and more senators who are openly talking about the president in negative terms and clearly angry with him. And you don't – a minority has a lot of power in the Senate. So, you know, if they lose one seat, as you saw in healthcare, the Democrats and these disaffected Republicans and could cause a lot of – I mean, they could tie up everything for the president. And they could end up supporting investigations.
Well, let's say you're high up in the Republican Party, like some of these people who Nancy McClain was talking about as, like, you know, donors and people who are really steering the agenda of the Republican Party. If you're one of them, what are the things you want? You want to get your judges in, and you want your tax cut. So if the Senate flips control, you're not going to get your judges anymore. At least you're going to get very different kinds of judges. You're not going to get like that crazy Bush guy who is a birther type. You're not going to get the kind of judges that you might otherwise get. And, you know, and the tax cut is looking kind of dicey at this point. And so to purely get away from all the stuff that appears in our news feeds and on television, what happens when the policy agenda evaporates?
Yeah.
And the one thing that those guys got that they really liked was they really liked getting Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. They liked that a lot. But when that stops happening, then what? And if the Senate looks like it might flip, that jeopardizes a major part of their priorities. And at that point, things start looking different. And this is just purely – this is sort of the conspiracy-minded view of somebody behind the scenes pulling strings saying, okay, we're not going to get our agenda. Now what?
But you don't have to be conspiracy-minded. I mean, that even that sentiment reflects many people in the political
game.
Right. Senators think that way.
Right. I mean, it's not a conspiracy if they all think alike.
Right. Good one. But they all do think about their party and they think about their future. So Mitch McConnell's looking at this too.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure he is frustrated and I'm sure he is not happy, not necessarily on the principles. We don't know that.
He wants to win.
The reporting is he is actually quite upset with what's going on.
Okay, but he presumably wants to win.
He wants to win, but certainly the loss of health care was, you know, devastating for him.
Right.
And he's going to want something.
Right. So the loss of the agenda has got to be a big deal for any party that controls, look, dozens of state houses, Congress on both the House and the Senate side, and the White House. This is a party that should be riding high and should be getting at least some policy goals. It should be doing more than renaming some post offices and getting one Supreme Court justice. The Supreme Court justice was a win, but purely from an operational point of view, that's not a really good return on the amount of dominance that is currently enjoyed by their party.
What do you think it says? How do you feel to shift again about him and the comments this weekend of the, you know, you're a smart guy, you study a lot, you write a lot, but what does it say about the country at this point that this is the president of the United States and these are the kinds of comments he made? I saw a discussion yesterday. One of my colleagues over at CNN, Jeff Toobin, was saying he was pushing back against everyone, saying this isn't news. This is what he's doing. And he goes, what do I know? Why should I say this is going to be some big turning point? He got elected doing this. His support has been the same almost doing this.
Yeah.
So that maybe this is part of the – this is what the country's okay with. And then others pushed back saying not – I've been thinking about that. I was curious what you feel.
It's not so much that – I mean, just to get back to the idea that not that many people agree with the sentiments that are being made by Donald Trump.
Yep.
But just – there just does seem to be a weird brokenness in national conversation where even though most people believe a certain thing and even though these facts are noticed by people who work in media for a living, who write for a living, these things are noticed by everyone in the room at some level, and yet we're still weirdly trapped, like we're standing on flypaper and we can't move. And that is a very strange phenomenon in which we are just trapped. And the only, you know, one possible answer is that the conversation is broken because it's, you know, it's really convenient to bash the media for going off after shiny objects. But, you know, so maybe one possibility is that the mechanisms of our national conversation are broken. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that there's this disconnect between party actors and power actors who are in a position to do things and the public pressure that may be brought to bear on them. And if you look at something like getting back to the Affordable Care Act repeal, like the BRCA and so on, those were pieces of legislation that only had about 20% support from the public. And so another possibility is that as imperfect as American modes of communication are, I can turn on the TV and I can see you or I can see Ana Navarro or I can see whoever saying things that seem reasonable, that seem like they notice what's going on. Maybe the thing that's broken is that the path from the public conversation to outcomes is broken. And so that can be a connection that's broken. This disconnect between how people feel, either because they're polarized and so people are splintered into, you know, factionalized into different groups, or just Toobin knows what's going on, but Marco Rubio is not listening.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that's a very powerful way to capture it. I think there's many people who feel like they're just watching it and they're angry. They don't agree with it. But, you know, you move on to the next day and nothing dramatic will happen. Maybe that's what President Trump's counting on. He can actually say whatever he wants.
Right.
And no one's going to do anything. Yeah. That's the big secret in American politics. Everyone always has restraint and says you can't do that. And what he discovered in the primaries is you can actually do it and you can move forward and there's no
– Well, a breakdown of norms where there are all these rules that bind us in society, things that we do for each other, for our neighbors, for our colleagues, for people in the public space. And there's this network of rules that hold us together. It's not that there's a piece of paper, the Constitution, that holds us together. It's that we hold that and we turn it into something alive.
Yeah.
And he came through and he just threw a bunch of bombs and said, well, I don't know, this seems pretty fragile. And he goes to crack, 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 and he's able to break all these things. And that's kind of fascinating by itself. I mean, that's really the thing that we're experiencing as a country.
Yeah, but I think it's the public inaction, which is or public action, which will ultimately be important. I mean, that gets back to the conversation about Democrats. That the party in the country didn't change in the 50s or 60s because some journalist at the New York Times wrote a hard-hitting article on race or because Humphrey made that speech. It was ultimately this, you know, historic grassroots movement that forced the conversation to move in a different direction. And yeah. There's some of that now. But
well, the thing is, there is this geographic polarization in which both Democrats and Republicans are holed up into different towers of separate opinion. And so one challenge that the Democrats have not solved, it's not so apparent now because they're out of power, but they also have a problem of not really being a national party, that they have not reached into all the counties of the United States. I mean, they, you know, they could, but there's something missing there where you talk about a pluralistic society. Well, you know, not everybody wants a pluralistic society. So how do you make something that's, I don't know, pluralistic without being threatening?
Yeah.
And so I think there's something going on there where I remember back in the campaign watching on MSNBC some Beyoncé concert the weekend before the election. And, you know, and I don't know, that worked for somebody. But it's easy to imagine there are voters who are just not into that in any way whatsoever.
But Democrats have to be careful because, you know, there was all the post-election discussion of having to reach the Trump voter and move away from identity politics. And, and all of a sudden it's like, well, OK, maybe I think maybe some Democrats are going to rethink that, that there's something to the policies that the party has stood for. Well, and you can't reach voters doing anything.
If you remember the Democratic convention, there was a day during the convention when the themes were patriotism and love of country and decency.
Yeah.
And there was a whole day of that. And that was a moment in which there was this effort to capture that feeling of loving your country and having one country. And that it's funny because it was I thought it was very effective, but it seemed then it got washed away in a wave of what about her email and John Podesta's risotto recipes and all this other rot that swept through the public awareness.
Well, there is. I mean, patriotism is a it could be a powerful issue and it could be useful for Democrats, especially in the era of Trump. I mean, meaning it's his presidency is about discord and division and separation. You could imagine Democrats making that an important theme beyond economics of national unity. I don't know. I'm not a politician, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
But we'll see. So I think that's it for our conversation. I don't know where you conclude. I think like many people, the two of us are watching this probably both a little stunned, but both of us, on the other hand, not totally surprised. And I think that's a thread through today's discussion.
Surely nothing will happen between recording time and airtime.
I'm sure there'll be about 10 news stories. But one thing that won't happen is that this thread of conservative populism, which touches on all these themes, remains integral to President Trump. And I think that people really moved beyond that after the election. I really do. I mean, I think all the conversation said Democrats are not reaching out to the economic concerns of working or middle class Americans, or Hillary Clinton was not a good candidate. But there is another argument that this conservative populism, which has a long history of dealing tackling nativism and playing on racial backlash to win votes, is at the heart of him as a politician. I don't know if it's strategic. I don't know if he believes that. I don't know what the internal, but it's clearly part of what he does. It's front and center this weekend, and I think that won't go away. We're going to see it again and again and again. It's like the tweets.
Yeah, okay. So we'll let's see where that rocket ends up.
All right. Well, that wraps up our episode, and we will be back soon. Thanks for joining us on Politics and Polls.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.